This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Like a lot of us, Peter Goen enjoys a walk in the woods and taking in the peace and beauty of the natural world. But when he looks at Mother Nature, he sees something different from most. He's interested in the way humans create fake environments and then call them nature. Golf courses, gardens, some examples, but there are more subtle samples as well. Goen has a new exhibit of photographs at the Gregg Museum of Art and Design at North Carolina State University. It's called Human Nature. It documents the way in which nature and the modern world are created by culture. The exhibit is showing through the 26th. There's an opening reception tonight at the museum. Peter Goen is a professor of art in photography and videography at the University of Nevada, Reno, and he joins us now. Welcome, Peter. Good to have you here.
It's my pleasure.
Tell us about this idea of the creating, the artifice of nature.
Well, the idea is that when we go outdoors, itself an interesting word, and we take a walk, we want to have that experience. It comes back from our Emersonian traditions, that concept of experiencing nature to build solace and to find solace and comfort in the natural world. Yet when we explore those worlds, there's something that happens when we realize that it's a human-constructed world. And how does that then change our sense of ourselves to realize we're walking in our own imagination?
Yeah, but don't we, I mean, if we walk out into some natural wonderland, untouched, unspoiled, a virgin forest of some kind, I mean, that's how do we construct that?
Oh, that's perfect, the virgin forest. That's actually something how this all started when you think about the word virgin. In fact, this actually had something to do with the origin of this project here in North Carolina. I drove by this forest and it had the sign Virgin Forest. And I naively thought that virgin meant that it was an old growth forest. Now using the correct term, virgin forest meant unharvested, that it was an agricultural forest. And the trees were all in rows and they were all of the same age and same species. And it was this phenomenal monoculture. So the concept of a virgin forest is not that place where we haven't walked or the place where we can find our own private experience with nature. It was agricultural developed land. And it provokes that question. So what is the landscape in which we walk? And tracing it back and studying it, you realize that going back to before the conquest, that the North American continent was heavily mediated by human and animal activity and to degrees that are still confounding us.
So, but if we look at, again, I'm kind of trying to get this concept of like I go to the Grand Canyon and I am awestruck. And I didn't make that. Part of what bowls me over is that I can't do that, and maybe none of us can. We can wreck it. We can put a dam at the front of it, but we can't make a thing like that.
Well, in fact, we think we can. And that's what's interesting. We're building rainforests in Costa Rica. We're modifying all kinds of habitats. You look at the central prairies in this country, and we think, oh, we need to preserve the prairie. And I certainly understand the diversity of plants and animals in the prairie lands. And I'm familiar with the Land Institute and West Jackson and all the interesting ideas about restoration and preservation of native species. Of course, native species has its own kind of polemic. But the origin of those landscapes were originally forested landscapes, were mediated by Aboriginal cultures and societies to provide landscapes for game so that they could survive in their own world. And so if we live in a mediated world, that's fine. Once we accept it, then who gets to decide what mediated world we live in and to what standards? And that's a very interesting place to go in your imagination.
So we're making up this natural world based on, first of all, a value that something about this thing called nature is a good thing. And then we have a vision of what it should look like and we make it look that way.
And we don't talk much about what that nature should be. We just kind of assume it should be whatever it is. We have this idea from our historic and literary traditions that nature should be something that we imagine it to be, someplace where we don't live but we go to. And part of my idea is that we are actually much more a part of the natural world than we have been willing to truly admit. And I think contemporary literary and academic scholarship undermines this point that our future really depends on our integration and understanding that we are part of nature, not separate from it.
Not apart from it. So, well, we've got some of the photographs here. And actually, if you're at a place where you can access the web, you might want to go to our website, wunc.org. And we can walk you through a couple of these things because we've got these photos up on our website, and you can take a look as we talk about them. So we're at WUNC.org. We're also here in the studio. Let's take a look at this first one, an abandoned pier building north of Surf City.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, and this goes on all the time, is that we have these storms, the nor'easters, we have, weather modification. I love this concept of weather modification. It goes back to 1977, the Weather Modification Board, an aspect of the U.S. government, predicted that by the end of the next century, the century we're now in, we could control the weather. I love the hubris of this. And so the idea of these storms coming in, we live in these coastal environments not imagining that we are really subject to forces that we can't actually control, which is part of really coming to terms with human concepts of what we can do and can't do. And so this particular photograph, what I found interesting is how that pier that's damaged and survives, though, is it looks so much to me like a dinosaur, both physically and metaphorically, in terms of how we live in coastal regions. We don't adapt to coastal variations. We try to control it. And that's still an operating concept in today's coastal management.
And then we don't account for the law of unintended consequences. So when we try to control it and can't, we still mess it up. So we don't control weather, but we sure have wrecked it.
Well, we're kind of acting as if we don't know what we're doing. But the idea of privatizing financial gain and socializing risk is really reflected in coastal management.
But it also brings us to this idea of what is modifying the environment and what is natural. So to some extent, I think what I hear you saying is that a hornet's nest, which modifies the environment, it makes the tree different than what the tree would have done to itself, is like an office building. I mean, we're a part of nature. We make things. Hornets make things. They change the landscape. It's all natural. Why do we make a distinction?
Well, taking that a little bit differently, the idea of having a hornet's nest is that animal species adapt to us just as we adapt to them. And so we have this adaptive world where these forces are at play. And the consequences of these adaptations, that's the creative edge that's so fascinating to look at. What actually is created? Look at pigeons. Look at how they adapt. Raccoons. Look at the animals that adapt to human presence. What's interesting to me is that we don't tend to value those in the same way. We only value the exotic species that have some kind of native sensibility to them. Now in the American West, for example, we want to save all of the burros and the wild horses, yet those are not native. Mm-hmm. And so there's a very interesting relationship to how we work with species that adapt to us, and they are. And hornets adapt to humans.
Not to mention how we denigrate some of the better ones, and we call those things in our gut parasites, without which we wouldn't be here.
Well, in the same way you look at the term, speaking of language, weed. You know, what's a weed? Well, the weed doesn't know it's a weed, and yet we call it a weed. It's really a plant that's not desired in its particular biological community, not desired by other humans, yet it thrives in adapting to us. And why is it that most of the other species that adapt to us, we don't particularly care for? There's an interesting creative edge here in this conversation.
Let's go to another picture. Again, if you want to go to WUNC.org, you can see these. Golf course at Marriott Hotel Desert Springs Resort, Palm Desert, California, 1987.
And this one, a lot of people say, why is a golf course nature? Well, let's talk about the walk. We're going to take a walk. Well, I mean, this is a way of respecting the institution of going out and having a walk with purpose, right? We need to have a purpose when we walk places. So we're going to hit a golf ball on this day of the Masters, right? We're going to hit a golf ball. We're going to track it down, and we succeed by concluding its placement. So we take these walks, but really it's something different. It's that this was originally a sand dune. And so we transform it. We make it useful. We pull all of the water from beneath that sand, from the ground, and then we irrigate this to create this environment for our own recreation. And, of course, the golf course is defined legally as an agricultural land, and that's how it gets the exemptions from the tax codes, so the water rates are less. So a golf course is essentially an agricultural landscape. And agricultural landscapes are the new nature, if we really begin to think about agriculture.
Well, and it's the quintessence of the point that you were making earlier, that we really want to we like nature, but we really want to control it, and you don't dare adapt to us, so we'll adapt the environment. We want it to be green. We want to have trees and water. and we want to shape it and keep it tame.
And it needs to be organized. We like the organized. You know, there's something about Frederick Law Olmsted and the managed garden. And I'm quite fascinated with Central Park in New York. You know, there are people who live in New York who don't know that that's a completely managed, created landscape. And they think that is their wilderness. That is their nature. Yet that is a completely architectural, developed, natural landscape. Of course, golf courses are the, as you said, the quintessential, naturally controlled landscape that we feel comfortable in because it doesn't have that wildness to it.
Probably no bugs on the grass either. Pacific Ocean at Cabrillo National Monument in San Diego. Ocean, for goodness sake.
And that has a sign on it that says that you can't go onto the rock, which you see there, because it's for plant rehabilitation. And, of course, there are no plants to be seen, or it's only rock. So why are we saying don't go here for plant rehabilitation? It's because the landscape has completely fallen off into the ocean. But the sign remains. And it's you know, the subtlety of humor of how we begin to think about what we can do and what we can't do. And, of course, I'm very interested in, not to go too deep into this, but the French theory of signage and using signs to indicate what we can do and can't do. For example, don't walk on the grass. You know, and in my neighborhood, as it is for so many other neighborhoods, if you have grass, it becomes essentially a pet bathroom. So all these people are making pet bathrooms out of their ornamental grasses. What's the ethic here that we're really trying to create? And that's part of what this photograph has attempted to really enlighten the visual experience about, is that you're asked to not go to a place that realistically can't exist.
Well, and I think signs also point to another aspect of your work, which is the power of language to shape our understanding of these things that we think come to us at birth. We know what nature is, and we're naturally, you should pardon the expression, drawn to it. We make it up with our language, don't we?
We make it up with our language. And, of course, nature itself is a socially created construct, and that's part of the idea of the photographs. And also, I think it's really important to begin to realize that in many ways we use language. I started out earlier with the word outdoors.
Which means you have to oppose that to something that's indoors. And
right. We live indoors.
Yeah, yeah.
So to experience nature, we have to go out of our doors.
Well, and that Emersonian idea that you point to, I mean, this comes to at a time when suddenly Western Europe finds itself apart from nature. It notices nature. So that means we don't feel the same relationship to it that one who wouldn't notice nature but simply lives in it. We talk about it in a very different way when it's something else.
Well, what's interesting to me is I was invited on a lecture tour to Northern Europe and discovered that they love this idea, and they explained to me that they're importing the concept of wilderness and creating 1 kilometer blocks of wild lands that are not managed, their definition. In other words, they plant some things and then don't ever do anything again. And they love the wildness, and this concept of wilderness as an exportable concept is fascinating to them. Yet most Americans don't realize that wilderness is a concept.
We have to make it up. And it begins to have economic value once we structure it so that in places like Costa Rica, we're creating rainforests.
We're creating rainforests and managing these environments, trying to decide what species belong there, what species don't belong there. And this kind of decision making is fascinating and I think should be more publicly discussed. What if we want to do something different? And it goes back to the concept of the Buffalo Commons, which I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about in the northern part of the western United States, to create these huge avenues for buffalo to roam once again. I mean, there's a romance to this, which goes back again to the origins of our love of nature.
But what's wonderful about it is how we construct it. And once we do, how we believe it, it really does remind us a bit of the Truman Show, doesn't it?
Why don't you let me fix you some of this new Mococo drink? All natural cocoa beans from the upper slopes of Mount Nicaragua. No artificial sweeteners.
What the hell are you talking about? Who are you talking to?
I've tasted other cocos. This is the best.
What the hell does this have to do with anything? Tell me what's happening!
Well, you're having a nervous breakdown. That's what's happening.
You're part of this, aren't you?
There we go. Yeah, the Truman Show. But that's it. We kind of make it up, then we believe it. And then should you resist, it might cause trouble with your neighbors.
Well, in fact, you know, the Truman Show is such an apt analogy because in a way we live in this world through our own willingness to be fooled. And it's not that we are fools. It's that we enjoy living in these imaginary worlds. And, you know, the other side of it is we're still having that experience. The thing about Truman was that character is that he's still living a noble life. It was only when he discovered the artifice that it began to break down. You know, once we look behind the curtain, bringing up the Wizard of Oz, but, you know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Once you notice that, it changes your awareness. As long as you believe that what you're experiencing is nature, you will continue to have that experience. My question is, once we become aware of the language of it, what's interesting is, I contend we still experience the same solace.
So when you go to a magic show and know it's all a trick, you go over and over and over again because you're just amazed that that thing keeps working.
The illusion is still effective, and we still believe it in the same way we look at a photograph, and we know intellectually it's not factual, but we love the truths that it represents.
And because it's part of our organic minds, it's all natural.
It's all natural. Right. We can look at a black and white photograph and we just assume it's natural, as if somehow in this transformation the world was black and white and then became color. We just accept it as if it is part of that factual reality.
Peter, what a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Likewise, thank you.
Peter Goen, professor of art and photography and videography at the University of Nevada, Reno. His exhibit, Human Nature, is up at the Gregg Museum, NC State, through the 26th. Going to be an opening recession. Well, there's a recession all the time now. Unemployment's 8%, but you're working, bless you.
And there's a talk tonight, too.
A talk tonight, too, from 6 to 8 tonight at NC State. For more information about the event, go to our website, wunc.org. We've got links. We've got pictures from the exhibit, and we're always happy to have you on the website. State of Things produced by Alex Granados and Isaac Davey Aronson, Sean Wen, Nicole Campbell, Christina Blides, the intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, the news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.